If you lived here, a version of that, and Greenpoint. And if you lived here, has been a very... Oh, thanks for the photo. If you lived here, it was also a very particular influence for us when Hila, Wilfried, Jesko and I started to discuss what kind of exhibition could Wohnungsfrage be, then very often your exhibition, if you lived here, came up, which was first exhibited in 1989 at the Art Foundation. And it was, in a way, also for you, probably quite a new format, in a way, to work within as an artist.
Yes, it certainly was. I was invited to have an exhibition as an artist, and it became clear to me that what I should really do was to collect the work of other people from quite a few different fields to address the question that was just becoming very apparent of homelessness and housing insecurity. So rather than being the author of the works, I decided to be the organizer of the works and of the events, and have the institutional embrace allow us to spread outward, and also to blur the distinction between the institution as a place of the display of high modernist art, which is what DIA was, to move it into a greater social engagement, if I can put it that way.
Do you have some? Do you want to show some images, actually, of if you lived here?
Yeah,
maybe to illustrate a bit this variety of media, variety of different agents within that exhibition.
Well, first, let me say, to explain what I'll be showing, that it was three separate exhibitions rolling into each other in a sense, but still separate with separate hangings. And I had only very poor slides of the exhibition because I never imagined that people would want to see pictures of it afterward, since for me it was a process event and not an exhibition in the sense of something you want to show installation shots of. So most of the images are poor digitizations because they come from poor slides. Furthermore, there are very few details. And because of the very large number of works in the show, I'll be showing only a very small number of things. So it's always inadequate, but I will begin. And can you see, I'm trying to go, can you see the PowerPoint behind me on the screen? No?
No.
Okay.
And then, yes.
Okay, so I'm going to disappear, which means, am I visible to you?
No, we have a split screen. It's good. Okay, we see you, and we see an image, which is the poster of If You Lived Here.
This is the poster. So why don't we continue talking together? I'll go through it and you can stop me. I can't see you or myself right now. I'm just talking about the actual setup so the audience understands. So this is the poster for the exhibition designed at my end. And the exhibitions were Homefront, Homeless, and City. So Homefront, Homeless, the City, the Street, and Other Venues, and City. And then there were, as it says, video screenings, film screenings, and there were also discussions, housing, artist life work, homelessness, and planning. And there were other ad hoc events, including poetry readings. So I'm going to take a second and explain the title, If You Lived Here, which comes from a fairly common real estate slogan of the day, if you lived here, ... you'd be home now. Now, these images were not in the show. I'm just using them to explain what we were doing, what I was doing, with the title. And these were the exhibition cards for each of the three shows. So these were postcards. And because Dia was a high modernist space and it was virtually invisible, I painted something at the time rather transgressive on the outer door, which is, come on in, we're home. And these are just some views of a couple of the shows. Each of the shows had some kind of flyer associated with it, which were posted in various places. And this is one for one of the forums and for a film screening. And this is one of the film flyers. Another one. So this was about Greenpoint.
How often did these events take place? The readings, presentations, etc.
Well, it depended on when people were available. So for the public forums, I think they were about every 3 weeks or a month, and these public events were as needed. I've never thought about how often they were because they were irregularly scheduled. I see this one as Tuesday, February 1st. Well, I don't know. I guess a Tuesday night, but they could have been any day of the week. And it's so long ago that I can't recall. Now that you've asked me the question, I'll have to spend some time thinking about it.
Martha, I just got a message. If you press F5, then you have full screen, or you can read my thoughts, apparently.
Oh, yeah. That's why. Yes.
Well, we know each other.
Yeah. Okay, so that's now full screen,
yeah,
yes?
Fantastic, yeah.
So each of the shows had a slogan painted on the wall. You can imagine how absurd that must have seemed in the high art world of the day, but I thought it was a good idea.
What was the reaction among your fellow artists?
Well, which ones? The ones in the show or the ones not in the show?
In terms of those who knew your work from before, and how did they react to, because it was also a different position that you took somehow in the public realm.
I don't recall any negativity directed at me directly from anybody I knew. So again, this isn't, I don't stop to think about those things that often, though I did notice eventually that no reviewers were writing about the show. And I heard from an editor that was because they were uncertain about how to address a work like this on this kind of topic. It was a little bit taboo.
Yeah. Well, that was a bit why I was asking. It's something that we thought also a lot here doing that exhibition. Well, who are those we address such an exhibition, because the topic is so broad, and one tries to be very inclusive, to include all sorts of different agents within the field or different fields. And I think this, I didn't see the show in 1989, but this apparently made or created its own story in a way, the story of that exhibition as a very public intervention.
Well, one of the things that working with my assistant, Dan Wiley, who was not only a young artist, but also had connections to both the academic urbanist population, but also to various advocacy groups, we constructed our own audience that was sort of overlapping with, but not the same as, the art audience. So the events were populated as well by people who were working with these groups or part of these groups, and we had activists and advocates exhibiting materials in the galleries at the same, alongside artworks. And my general idea was, I would say to people, you know, if you would like to be represented, we can help you put something together.
Right.
One of the things that we did was to have various graphs and other really non-art material in what I called the waste space of the gallery, which is above eye level, but not above visibility. So these are, I just threw them together onto a couple of slide panels, but there were these various not very beautiful graphs and blow-ups from newspapers and advertisements from the New York Times, the newspaper of record, crowing about how great it was to live in wealthy enclaves where life at the top, where even the weather is different, and new works by Frank Stella and 19 other important artists, for example. So you'd have these statistics on housing inequality together with ads for life at the top. And a not very good slide of one of the corners of the first exhibition, Homefront, with various works about New Brunswick, New Jersey, Puerto Rico, and I guess, and an activist work off, trailing off on the left about a New York, a Manhattan event. And then the video, one of the two video viewing stations, we put down ugly furniture and strange rugs, again, a very low culture or domestic. This is the reading room and Chinatown History Project. This keeps jumping ahead of me. And the other video set up in the same exhibition. So we've seen two small corners of the first show. With various works. And these are just examples of the kinds of works that were in the show, though I could have shown many different kinds, but.
Yeah. How would you, go on.
No, just the front and back of the reading room. What were you saying?
Yeah, how would you maybe describe the difference between the situation then in 1989 when you did this exhibition and the situation now? Because it seems a bit that was somehow the beginning start of the neoliberal era in a way. And in the foreground were, of course, already then beginning of discussions on gentrification, homelessness, and other phenomena. But today, this very exhibition is, of course, also seen within the current context in 2015. And is there another reception, another view on that exhibition? How would you view this exhibition if you lived here under the current conditions, 2015?
You're asking what is the retrospective view on this show?
No, what's somehow the relevance of that show today within the current situation, let's say in within gentrification processes in Manhattan and Brooklyn, for instance?
Well, I don't know how to answer that. If the same show were up today, people would have more recognition of the procedures that neoliberalism has set underway in the production of hyper-speed gentrification, and there's by this time much more apparent wealth disparity, and also the very determined effort on the part of the city to drive all but the wealthy out of Manhattan below 95th Street is clear now, which is why we can say Brooklyn without laughing. But I don't think, well, the exhibition itself, of course, looks like an intrusion into a high art space from something else, something extremely marginal that looked like things that young artists might have been doing in shows like Colab or other shows on Rent. But also, I borrowed some of the strategies from my friends and predecessors in the Dia space, the group material. So there was this effort to bring those alternative strategies of messing up a high art space with material that was familiar from the streets to the streets. But what made these different, both for group material and myself, is that it was organized around the notion of an artist's response. I don't know if I'm answering your question, though. No, by the way, this is the interior reading room. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it has to do maybe also with the role of the artist that has changed during that time. Because today also it seems that artists have, they're not, of course, they're not only victims within this whole process. They're partly, could be also understood as avant-gardes of the real estate market to a certain extent. So I think the exhibition and your role within that also raises the question of the position of the artist as someone who's both involved within urban transformation and someone who's at the same time could that also take a position and maybe try to clarify things and to act as someone who you might call a public intellectual to a certain extent.
Well, I think it was fairly well understood, at least in a sector of the art world at the time, that artists were exactly in the wedge position that you were describing. And if I can refer to the book that we produced, If You Lived Here, which you are probably familiar with, my own essay, Fragments of a Metropolitan Viewpoint, takes on precisely the question of the pivotal role of artists as both the wedge of neighborhood busting, if you want, gentrification, but also eventually as its ultimate victims, as well as the people who are, in effect, their collectors, those with enough money to be higher up in the bourgeois scale, are able to drive them out.
Yeah, in that sense, it seems as if the artists have, or the creative class in general, have a almost schizophrenic role. Because they, unwillingly maybe, they also create the narratives of urban revitalization programs and urban branding and growth in cities around the globe. Because it seems, I think this is a real dilemma, I guess, that the very critique often coming from subcultural movements, they provide somehow also the decor of the next generation of those who buy out the residents.
Yes, and this is the creative class thesis that was developed into a codification and a selling package by the business evangelist Richard Florida, selling the idea that artists will make your city more beautiful and raise the real estate values. And in my researches on Richard Florida's thesis, it became clear that he actually wasn't thinking about artists, that they were a very minor part of that. The artists would perhaps set up little businesses on the side, like coffee shops and the like, but that the real creative class are people with high enough incomes to really transform a neighborhood, people in the IT industry, for example. So then I wrote another book called Culture Class, precisely taking on the question of the positioning of the artist as a figure in official city, state, and nationally driven gentrification plans.
I think in that book there's also one text from gentrification to occupation, which I think is at the very end of the book. Maybe you can, just in a few words, it's probably asked too much, but just in a few words, because we just had an amazing presentation by David Madden about commodification and a kind of urge for decommodification. And it seems to me that this is somehow related also to this pair, gentrification, occupation. What do you mean by occupation, not beyond maybe Occupy Wall Street?
Well, of course, it is related to the question of Occupy Wall Street, which was the outgrowth. I'm just going to stop for a minute and just say I'm now looking for the audience's sake. What I'm showing is this is the way the summary view of the show, these 3 Dia shows, traveled around for a while in various ways over the subsequent decades. This was at the Netherlands Photo Institute in Rotterdam in the year 2000. And this is the traveling archive. This is at Eflux. I'm sorry to interrupt the narrative for this. This is at Costco in Utrecht. And this, if the slide will advance, in La Verena. So not only did the archive travel, but with each iteration, there was a symposium on current conditions. This is La Verena, and this is the symposium. And this is a reprise of the show, of a piece of the show, in its pure form as the curator Jorge Ribalta could make it in Madrid this past year, but with lots of videos, which you are showing as well. And so back to this, and this is the Greenpoint project, which you have on display, which takes on directly the role of gentrification in communities that are working class and which become, shall we say, suffering what Kristen Reed called the developing invasion. One of the things that is apparent and which sociologists have pointed out, including my friend Sharon Zukin and her collaborators in a recent study in cities from Beijing to New York to Amsterdam, is that the high street in cities is usually populated by stores set up by immigrants from various places, and gentrification homogenizes neighborhoods and drives out the immigrants in business. So I've completely lost back.
That's no problem. Maybe we can continue actually with Greenpoint, since this is in the show, and I'm sure that many here are also interested to know a bit more about how this project started and how long actually it's has been going on.
Well, obviously it started quite a while ago. I don't know why it's obvious. I moved to Greenpoint in 86. So I was doing the If You Lived Here show while living in Greenpoint, which was, I used to call it, the village that time forgot. Because as my son, we'd lived in Dumbo before that, which was completely depopulated, except by artists, and was old warehouses. But in Greenpoint, as my young son said at the time, you could see people dressed with no irony in every era of clothing from the 1960s up to the present, to the late 80s, meaning that it definitely was not a, not fully integrated into the present. It was a fairly low income, highly, with many flows of immigrants, and particularly people from Poland, in a large wave after Solidarność began. And so when I started meeting my neighbors and the store owners, I realized that in fact it was much more complicated than that, that there really were people from many different countries who set up businesses there and who lived there. So if just on the panel I'm displaying now, there's Carmine Notaro and Teresa Stanchak and her mother and Sujit Kumar. So we have someone's there 30 years, someone's there 25 years, and someone who's there 7 years. So Carmine's, a neighborhood institution, closed 2 months ago. Teresa's business is still there, and Mr. Kumar has moved up in the world and has a much bigger business as well as this little one. I'm going backwards, sorry. There are also young Polish immigrants, Yemeni immigrants, at the lower left, Israelis, and hipsters, if I can call them that. So this little place, Eat, on the upper left, has just closed. I had dinner at the Triple Decker, which is the lower left, last night. This is classic Greek diner, and Abdul is part of Greenpoint's Finest Deli, which almost all the delis on the block, which are not properly called bodegas. It's just not a term that ever even entered this neighborhood. Hipsters think that New York delis are called bodegas, but that's in a Latino community. So all these stores are owned by Yemenis. These are my neighbors, the Pit Stop Bar at the end of my block, and they are white working class whose family has lived here over 100 years, an Egyptian guy who didn't want to be photographed at the bottom, and a Korean man, Mr. Kang, who's just had to move his store off the high street because the rents got too high. So let's see if there's... Right, and then this is full hipsterism here. Cafe Grumpy, which was in a TV show called Girls, which I've never seen. Five Leaves, which is a tourist attraction. And Locale, which did not stay in business, right across the street. A very good Thai restaurant where no one wanted to be photographed. And again, the... Greenpoint's Finest Yemeni Deli, the guys didn't want to be photographed. The point of that all, of course, is that they are almost certainly undocumented. And I couldn't leave out the police presence in the area. So this is the deputy inspector and their street fair. And these are too small to see, but these are hipster stores and non-hipster stores, sort of alternating in a string. And I'm almost done, by the way. And this is as of this last week or month. So there's Frank in front of the Pit Stop. Cheap Charlie's is starting to disintegrate, but it's still doing well. The pizza place is closed. USA Deli is called that because it's owned by Sikhs with turbans who didn't want to be attacked after 9/11. So, there's a defensive coloration there. White Dream, which was for the Catholic Church, it was about clothing for communion and similar church rituals, no longer has a place on the street. It's been there at least 30 odd years. Peter Pan. Dream Fishing Tackle is now an antique store. But not a hipster one. Dollar Up still exists. And here, the last panel or two will simply be how you know a hipster store when you see one, which everybody knows anyway. So the most brassy one is Woodwind and Brass, but the other sign is what hipsterism brings to the high street is a mock self-effacing sameness, boring black painted awnings, no front, and with a little standing board. So I guess uglification of the high street is a sure sign that you're in a hipster area, tastefully empty. And what's interesting about it is not just in terms of visuality, it literally reduces the diversity of people engaged in business on the high street. So I know I've moved a bit far away from...
No, that was perfect, because we really wanted to hear more about this Greenpoint project. Maybe one last question regarding the Greenpoint project. Is it ongoing? Ongoing project? Yeah, perfect.
At least since I live here and I carry a camera around with me, it is ongoing. However, what's really required is an explanation that is much less superficial than what I just gave, or at least has at least some sign that there is a pattern here and even, shall we say, a formula. Because every hipster knows what a hipster store should look like. So when you set up a hipster store, it's like what naming your own garage band was like back in the 80s. You had to call it something like Smashing Pumpkins or something like that, and though that's a grunge band. And it had to, you had to downscale yourself, because one thing about hipsterism is that in order to disguise one's bourgeois origins, you have to take on the look of modesty and understatement. One assumes that at some point there'll be a different approach, but the interesting thing to think about is that the hipster store always goes back to showing the logo of the store it's colonized. Someone said to me recently, in the next generation, people will think that the term hardware store means the place to get coffee. And a couple of the storefronts I showed actually had the old signs in place. So, in other words, there's a self-consciousness about colonization built right into the hipster format. And please don't ask me what hipster means, because I have no idea. But we can say gentrifiers of the culture class.
Maybe, Martha, if you agree, we can have at the end some questions from the audience, just to open it up and to make it technologically speaking more complex, just to test the limits of technology here. Are there any questions from the audience? I don't see any. There's one here. Just a moment.
Yes, hello, Martha. I was once on the bus and riding through South Williamsburg, and there were these two older women on the seat next to me who I think were kind of hard of hearing, and so they thought they were whispering, but actually they were kind of shouting. And one said, "This neighborhood used to be Jewish, and then it was Puerto Rican, and now it's hipster." And as if being hipster was a ethnicity in the way that that's based in New York is ethnically divided often and in these like complicated ways, but then also it's an aesthetic culture which has something to do with class, but not necessarily. And so I was wondering if you can see a distinction between hipsterism and dandyism, and if hipsters are different than like John Travolta's character in Saturday Night Fever, or like Run DMC, or any of these other kind of ethnic dandy, you know, traditions where you like you seek to escape your, you know, your kind of class, like the miseries of your class position by being beautiful.
Well, hi, Alan. Thanks for your questions. I think you've thought more about some of those things than I have, but I would say that it's probably not correct to go too far with thinking of the hipster as either a dandy or a flaneur. I think that's a self-chosen mask for bourgeois origins in this case. And in both, well, not the dandy, but certainly the flaneur often represents somebody who's could otherwise be more of a social climber. In other words, the John Travolta figure from Saturday Night Fever, which represents people from my era with defined ethnic backgrounds, in that case Italian, trying to flee Brooklyn, which was identified as fully working class and of a place where you're not going to get ahead to do anything. So I don't see that as a hipster identity. Hipsters come from often small towns or cities in America's heartland, which I'll say something, a barb, I'll produce a barb about that in a minute, and who are often suburban, move to New York City to develop an imaginary cosmopolitan identity, which by their very suburban ideals and identities and cultural preferences, they've already destroyed. So around the corner from me on the high street is a bar called Lake Street. There are no lakes in New York. This is based on a band identity developed by the owners in Minnesota. We're in an era when people who move from Minnesota want to bring Minnesota to New York City, whereas a city like New York used to be the great bastion of cosmopolitanism that referred more to, say, San Francisco and Europe than to the heartland in Minnesota. So I think that's a very an easy index to see the way in which that hipsterism is effacing the notions of high culture and high cosmopolitanism of high modernism by a kind of virtue-oriented pretend humbleness of small-town identity. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
There's another question over here.
Okay. Wow, psychedelic visual effect.
Go ahead, yeah.
Hi, thank you, Martha, for being with us virtually today. Question for you about, if you lived here, the Greenpoint Project, your work with other artists, as you say, becoming the organizer and not being the author in some way, and how, if you could talk a little bit more about the process of working with the artists and how you came about working with the artists that you did.
Hi, first, I hope you didn't say community organizer because that wasn't my role, okay? So thanks for the question, but I just wanted to be clear, I wasn't a community organizer, but I was working with my local Greenpoint community, but that was strictly aside from this project. One thing that I did was that I called on my network of artist friends to recommend friends, but also we put out a call for artists, and I have to say particularly photographers, because photographers didn't often and don't often feel welcome to participate in projects run by art institutions. So we had various calls out for people to apply to be in the show. I had one basic rule, which was only violated once within an art project that I hosted, which was I didn't want any images of people lying around on the street. My feeling being that if the show was in New York City, if you wanted to see people lying on the street, you should step out onto the street where far too many people were highly visible sleeping on the street, as they are once again. So this was networks of artists talking to other artists, and Dia also helping to put out a call. And then I have to say a really important part of the exhibition was approaching advocacy organizations that would never normally think of having a presence in an art gallery, no matter how small or how marginal, though it's funny to say that about Dia, and offering to help them put together a project if they would like to be present, and also artists groups who normally wouldn't show within an institution like that.
Okay, I think, Martha, we have come to an end here of that discussion. I thank you so much for joining us from the morning in Brooklyn. We hope to see you very soon in person here in Berlin.
I'm really sorry to have missed the opening and to see everybody. I may be back in Berlin
in a month. We hope so. We'll do another event then, or something private. Thank you so much, and hope to see you very soon. Thank you. So after the conversation with Martha Rosler, we will come to our next talk, which is a kind of explanation and maybe also framing of one of the one-to-one models that you see in the exhibition, a project that I think relates in an interesting way to Martha Rosler, but also to David Madden's contribution. And especially to Martha Rosler's contribution, since we will talk about a housing project for artists or for what we just called the creative class, which is also one of, I think, an especially interesting topic within the city of Berlin that is very well known all over the globe as a creative city with all the implications that this has. And it's a pleasure to welcome Dogma, an architectural practice founded by Pier Vittorio Aureli and Martino Tatara, and Realism Working Group, an initiative of artists who collaborate with Dogma and were acting as the client of this little one-to-one project. If I may ask you to come to the stage, are you here?